Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
A very good morning to everyone. Before we begin the cases of the day, we have an admission to the bar. If Mr. Justin Andrews would come to the podium, please. I have the honor of making this motion, actually. Judge Bauer, Judge Mannion, I have the honor of moving the admission of the bar this morning of Mr. Justin Andrews. Mr. Andrews is a member of the bar of the state of Illinois and has served as my law clerk throughout this last year. He, after receiving his undergraduate degree from Ball State University in Indiana, he went on to the George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C., where he received his J.D. degree last year. Mr. Andrews will be leaving us soon. He has served the court with distinction and will be assuming a post as an associate attorney in the firm of Winston & Strawn here in Chicago. Judge Bauer, I have to warn you, though, that he is simply on loan to the state of Illinois and that Judge Mannion and I do expect him to come back to Indiana in very short order.
Will you give me pause then on whether I should grant the motion? I admire both your sponsor and your future employment, and I welcome you to the Illinois bar as well.
Thank you.
The motion is obviously granted unless Judge Mannion has a dissent.
Not me. Thank you.
Step over to the clerk's desk. They will administer the oath. Now we'll put Mr. Andrews and his colleagues to work. The first case on this morning's call is number 04-1299, Harry Edelson against Raymond K.F. Shin and Peter Y.H. Young in Asia Pacific Online. Mr. Brem.
Good morning, Judge Bauer, Judge Ripple, Judge Mannion. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Brem. I'm the attorney for plaintiff appellant Harry Edelson. Before I begin addressing the merits of this appeal this morning, I would like to call the panel's attention to the statement of urgency at the outset of our initial brief. This case, as the panel is aware, arises from a denial of a preliminary injunction pertaining to the 2003 annual general meeting of defendantchina.com. The China.com annual meeting is typically held each June, so the new meeting is about to be upon us. Accordingly, while we are mindful of this court's exceedingly busy schedule and heavy docket, if the court could find some way to rule upon this matter expeditiously, perhaps by rendering its decision first, followed by an opinion later, our client, Mr. Edelson, would be most appreciative. That said, I'll turn to the merits of Mr. Edelson's appeal. This case fundamentally arises out of the district court's decision that Mr. Edelson had no standing as a stockholder but a former director of China.com to bring a suit under Section 13D of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. For four reasons, we believe that Mr. Edelson has standing. First and foremost, Mr. Edelson was, is, remains a China.com stockholder. In a leading Second Circuit case back in 1971, GAF versus Milstein, which this court in its Indiana National versus Rich decision acknowledged was the leading case on the area of standing and private rights of action under 13D. And in Jacobs versus Pabst Brewing, which is out of the District Court of Delaware, our express decision that stockholders do have standing to sue under 13D, which only makes sense because this court in Indiana National versus Rich said that the fundamental purpose of Section 13D is to protect stockholders. Implicit in the Indiana National versus Rich decision is standing for stockholders because their issuers were given standing to bring suits under 13D for injunctive relief.
And is that when there's a tender offer?
I'm sorry?
For a tender offer or when there's a takeover?
Well, when there is any potential change in corporate control. I know
That's substantial, though, and that's when the shareholder, and actually that's a defense for the company, isn't it, on behalf of the shareholder?
Well, if there is a violation of 13D, the purpose of 13D is that fundamentally it's a disclosure statute. So the issuer in Indiana National was given proxy for the stockholders to seek the requisite disclosures.
But that disclosure is necessary when there's going to be a substantial acquisition of stock, isn't it?
Well, 13D, the answer is yes. 13D is triggered by a substantial acquisition above the 5% threshold. And then the implementing SEC regulations mandate that if there is any change in the information that is filed, there have to be amendments. And here what we have was the filing by Mr. Yip, the CEO of China.com, defendant Mr. Yip, of Schedule 13G, the short form summary schedules, that manifested and expressly stated that there was no intent to change control.
Well, he's already in control.
He is a 5%, above 5% stockholder who only had 19% of the stock.
So what's new?
What is new is the change in his intent. Once he formulates an intent to change control of the issuer, which is the very purpose of 13D, to provide an early warning for a potential for change of control, he must disclose that so stockholders can make fully informed decisions.
Is the change in control the fact that he's going to wants to change the board of directors?
Absolutely. And I would refer to the court in that respect, and this is referred to in our initial brief, to Instruction 4 of Item D of the Schedule 13D. Schedule 13D itself is the schedule promulgated by the SEC. It's embodied in SEC Rule 13D-101. So it is a promulgated SEC regulation. We submit as a duly promulgated SEC regulation. It has the force and effect of law. It mandates what disclosures must be made, and it expressly provides that there must be disclosures of any plans or proposals which the reporting person may have, which relate to or would result in, among other things, any change, and I repeat, any change in the present board of directors.
What if it's not a contested change, that there is going to be other people that are coming on the board? Do you have to disclose that?
I would submit that disclosure would be required, because what would be the harm of that? If there's no contest, shouldn't shareholders be known, have it known that the major shareholders are in favor of the change? What we're talking about here is a simple matter of disclosure. Just state what your intentions are. It's not a hard thing to do, and it was not a hard thing for Mr. Yip to do. And here, we don't have that situation.
Why is an intent a plan or proposal?
I'm sorry?
Why is intent a plan or proposal?
Because the intent would be a plan or proposal, because he is planning to vote against a director.
That's not a plan or a proposal. That's a prerogative of intent, but it's not a plan.
I would submit it is indeed a plan. If you have an intent, you are planning to take a certain action. Are planning to vote.
If I look up the word intent, I will find as a synonym proposal
plan? I think you may. I have not looked up the word intent, but I think it would fall within, as particularly construed in light of the purposes, which are to provide full disclosure, the notion that you are going to vote against an existing directors if you're a major shareholder.
So before you get to vote, you have to tell everybody how you're going to vote.
If you're voting against the composition of the existing board, and if you're a major shareholder because you have a certain amount of voting power that could affect the outcome of this election. And let's put it in the context of what actually happened here, Judge Bauer. Here, the non-disclosure, and another fact that should be borne in mind, is that before he, in addition to not disclosing his intent, Mr. Yip was part of the board that made a recommendation to shareholders that they re-elect Mr. Edelson, that they re-elect J. Carter Bees, who was the other U.S. director who was voted off the board. These guys are two-thirds of the audit committee. They're the only U.S.-based directors of this company. But Mr. Yip participated in the board's recommendation that they be reelected by the stockholders. So Mr. Yip has first manifested, by virtue of his participation in the board recommendation, support for Mr. Edelson and Bees, but then he does not disclose any change in that support. And I submit that that is indeed a plan or proposal within the meaning of the implementing regulation, because there is very little that's more fundamental to a stockholder than their franchise and their ability to affect the composition of the board of directors. And what we are submitting simply is that if a major stockholder wants to vote against the existing board, tell the other stockholders about it. Had that been done, it would have triggered and put Mr. Edelson in a position to have stated his piece and not have presented the stockholders with a seemingly uncontested election when in fact there was a contested election. And what we wound up with here at this director's meeting was only 48% and change, I think it's 48.25% of the stock being represented either in person or proxy, of which 16 million shares of which are Mr. Yip's shares, which under our analysis of the case in Rule 13D1E2 are not eligible to vote at this meeting. So if you look at the implementing purpose of Section 13D, to provide full disclosure, we would submit that the intent to oppose the existing board of directors and to vote your substantial block of stock against them is squarely a plan or proposal within that.
Well, that's the way you would have to define it. You also have to reach, I think, to get a private right of action by a shareholder under 13D also, don't you?
I'm sorry, just...
A private right of action under 13D for a shareholder, an individual shareholder. Now, the district court made the distinction and said, well, it's not a shareholder, it's because he's a director, and that's really what his basis is. Therefore, he can't come in as a shareholder. But I'm not even sure that as a shareholder he has a private right of action.
Well, if issuers have private right actions under Indiana National versus Rich, and
issuer meaning the corporation.
The corporation.
And
the
has a private right of action.
He has a private right of action. And the rationale for extending standing to the issuer in that case was that it was representative standing. That the issuer's standing was essentially that of a representative of the stockholder.
Yeah, and when someone tries to take over the company or is going to buy a substantial part of stock, the issuer does look out for the individual shareholder.
Well, maybe. And it was with some reservation that the Indiana National Court extended standing to an issuer, because the Williams Act, of which 13D was a part, was designed to be an even-handed balancing between the rights of target management and the company and the takeover bidder. The Congress did not want to tip the balance one way or the other. By allowing an issuer to have standing, you do have the threat that the issuer may be using 13D as a defensive measure to fend off hostile takeovers.
Yeah, okay.
Notwithstanding that,
the Williams Act, I know it's in that Chris Kraft case, says that the Williams Act was the protection of investors who are confronted with a tender offer. Now, you're saying that they're confronted with what? What do you call it?
Well, any intent to change control.
Change control means change in board of directors.
Absolutely, fundamentally. Those are the people who control and run the company on an ongoing basis. And I would point out that Chris Kraft is a 14E case. It's a case involving damages, not injunctive relief. And it's a case in which the plaintiff in that case expressly disclaimed standing as a stockholder and said, asserted baldly, that a disappointed tender offer had standing to sue. I noticed that my 10-minute initial time is up. If the court has any more questions, that's fine, but I would like to save the balance of the time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Brett.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Cawley.
May it please the court, Tom Cawley for defendant AppleeChina.com. As this court has held, a preliminary injunction is an extraordinary and drastic remedy and should not be granted unless the movement has made a clear showing that he's entitled to such relief. In this case, Edelson is not entitled to a preliminary injunction because he cannot show a likelihood of success on a Section 13D claim against China.com. First, Edelson lacks standing to bring a 13D claim. Second, China.com, the only defendant against which a preliminary injunction is sought, has not violated Section D because its conduct is not regulated by that section. Finally, Edelson has not shown that he will suffer any irreparable harm during the pendency of this case that would warrant a preliminary injunction. Section 13D is part of the Williams Act. And as Your Honor pointed out, the Supreme Court said in Piper versus Chris Kraft that, quote, the sole purpose of the Williams Act was the protection of investors who are confronted with a tender offer. In Bath Industries versus Blott, this court held that Section 13D was intended to protect investors when there is an acquisition of shares in connection with a fight for corporate control. That is not the case here. While courts have held that there is a private right of action under 13D, that right is only available to the extent that it advances the legislative purpose of that section.
Who has that right?
Who has that right? A shareholder has that right, and a corporation has that right to the extent it's enforcing the rights of the shareholders. It's a disclosure statute that is designed to give shareholders the information they need when there's an issue concerning corporate control, either through a proxy or a tender offer or a large acquisition of stock, a very rapid acquisition of stock. So shareholders are confronted with, what should we do? We need the information. That's what 13D is designed to do. So it's either the shareholders or the corporation acting on behalf of the shareholders. In this case, there was no tender offer. And while defendant APOL at one point controlled 18.6% of China.com stock, there is no allegation that it was involved in a rapid aggregation of shares, which is the underpinning of Section 13D. Moreover, according to the complaint, APOL is controlled by defendant Yip, as Your Honor pointed out. He was the vice chairman and CEO of China.com for many years. Thus, there can be no argument that APOL was involved in a fight for corporate control of China.com. APOL is controlled by a member of China.com's management. Edelson incorrectly argues that Section 13D requires disclosure of how APOL intended to vote his shares so that he could decide whether to wage a personal proxy fight to keep his board seat. Nothing in the Williams Act suggested that the act was intended to provide such information to a director to protect his board seat. The fact that Edelson happens to be a shareholder is irrelevant. He brought this action in his capacity as a former director to regain his board seat. As the Supreme Court held in Piper, the mere fact that a plaintiff is a shareholder does not by itself confer standing under the Williams Act. In that case, the plaintiff was a tender offer who was also a shareholder, and that claim was brought under Section 14E of the Williams Act. And the Supreme Court held, despite the fact that the plaintiff was a shareholder, it was a tender offer and not the kind of shareholder that the Williams Act was designed to protect, that being a shareholder who's confronted with a tender offer or a large aggregation of stock, who needs to get information to determine what to do with the stock.
Is that the only time a shareholder would have a private right of action?
That's right, Your Honor, on 13D. Again, the Piper case did not deal with 13D.
But I mean, that as far as just in general terms, because the district court did make the distinction, saying, well, he may have the right as a shareholder, but he's really going after it as a director. Is that a correct assessment?
I think that is, Your Honor. I think there are situations where a director may also be a shareholder and have a right under 13D, but this is not
right
that case.
Right as what? A shareholder?
As a shareholder.
Yeah, I know, but that has to be with what you call an aggregation of stock.
Correct,
or
tender offer.
Tender offer.
Right. That's the only situation. That is the situation that's designed to protect. Some rapid aggregation of stock that is in connection with the design of control of the company. It's the drafters of the Williams Act said, what we have is we have no legislation that protects the individual investors when there's a corporate takeover. They have to get information. What does the party that intends to take over the corporation intend to do? You have to file statements with the SEC and with the issuer explaining what your intentions are. It's in the context of a change in corporate control or an intent to change corporate control.
Well, then, that's what bothered me. This wasn't the case.
Right.
And so, but the district court seems to say that he did have standing as a shareholder, but he wasn't acting as a shareholder.
Well,
and I don't even see where he has standing.
I don't either, Your Honor. My understanding of the district court's opinion is that she never got to the second issue about whether this was in the proper setting. I think she just held that because he's a shareholder and what the relief he's seeking is the capacity to get his board seat back, that he didn't even qualify as a shareholder. Shareholders are the people who are designed to protect. Then I think the next question would be, is this the kind of situation where 13D would apply? It's not. There's no tender offer. There's no rapid aggregation of stock. In addition to the issue of Mr. Edelson's standing, China.com plainly has not violated Section 13D. China.com is not regulated by that section. Section 13D only applies to shareholders that hold 5% or more of a company's stock. China.com is the issuer, not a large shareholder. Section 13D imposes filing requirements on large shareholders, not on issuer corporations.
At some point much earlier, did he actually make that filing? Did he ever acquire that amount of stock, or was he a founder, or how did he get all this stock?
Attached to the complaint, there were two 13G filings, which were indicated that that APOL had, I think, 1.14% and another 0.19% of the stock of China.com, indicating that he had that aggregation of shares. The complaint here is he didn't file a Form 13D, a Schedule 13D, indicating he intended to change control.
That's supplemental, though, isn't it? I mean, I just wonder whether he originally ever filed this.
Yes, he did. He filed a Schedule 13G, indicating he was holding the shares for investment purposes.
Oh, okay, that's what it was.
In his initial complaint, Edelson referred to the Section 13D violation of VIF and APOL, but there was no allegation in the complaint that China.com had violated Section 13D. In the original complaint, Mr. Edelson stated, quote, China.com is named as a defendant in this case in order to assure a complete adjudication of the issue and so that binding effective injunctive relief may be granted, end of quote. In response, China.com argued that Edelson cannot show a likelihood of success against China. Edelson cannot show a likelihood of success against China.com under Section 13D because they had no claim against China.com under Section 13D. Edelson then attempted to amend his complaint, and he argued that China.com had violated a rule of the SEC because it had counted APOL's vote as part of the board election. There is nothing in Rule 13D or Section 13D or any SEC rule that imposes any obligation on the issuer to determine whether shareholders have complied with 13D before counting votes. Thus, Edelson cannot show a likelihood of success under 13D against China.com for the additional reason that China.com is not regulated by and therefore could not possibly have violated Section 13D. Moreover, it's not clear that there was a violation of Section 13D by anyone in this case, much less by China.com. Edelson's 13D case is based on his assumption that when he and another director, Mr. Bees, who is not a party to this action, were voted off the China.com board, there was a change in control of China.com. That is not so. Control has been defined as the possession of the power to direct or cause the direction of the management and policies of the company. Here, the control of China.com never changed. China.com has had consistent leadership for years. Edelson and Bees were only two members of an eight-member board at China.com. By Edelson's own admission, he and Bees were not involved in the management of China.com. Indeed, Edelson states that his views were consistently ignored by management. The control of China.com did not change as a result of Edelson and Bees leading the board.
Those in control solidified their control, didn't they, by getting him off the board?
Arguably, they appointed two new independent directors. But the control did not change.
They didn't like this independent director.
That's true, Your Honor. And courts have held that 13D is not designed to be a tool for disgruntled former directors who are kicked off the board for whatever reason. It's a tool for shareholder protection, mm-hmm. confronted with a tender offer.
Well, my question is, though, is for whatever reason a bit broad. Supposedly, change in directors is part of a overall plan to solidify control.
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. My understanding is Mr. Bees and Mr. Edelson could not get along with the other members.
I'm not talking about the facts of the case. I'm talking about the law here. Yes. Would this section apply if indeed that's what was going on?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The section refers to a change of control. It doesn't refer to solidification of control. And there has not been a change.
Things are very often happen in steps.
True, but there's no indication of a plan to change the control of the company. The control of the company has been a change. Same. It's had the same managing directors, the same vice chairman, the same CEO for many, many years.
Would your client have liability as an aider and abettor of a violation of this section?
I don't see any. There's no cases that said that the Section 13D private right of action extends to aiding and abetting liability.
Why shouldn't it, though?
Well, first of all, there would have to be a primary claim before there can be an aiding and abetting claim. And I don't think this is the context where there even is a primary claim, much less an aiding and abetting claim. Finally, Edelson has not suffered any irreparable harm. This court has held that for purposes of preliminary injunction, the plaintiff must show that he needs a preliminary injunction to minimize the hardship to him during the pendency of the lawsuit. According to this court's decision in Allied Signal, Edelson must show that, quote, in the absence of the injunction, he will suffer irreparable harm for which there is no adequate remedy of law, end of quote. Edelson cannot make that showing. There is no impending or ongoing harm to Edelson that would warrant the imposition of a preliminary injunction. Edelson has already been voted off the board, and there is no hardship to Edelson during the pendency of this case that would warrant the extraordinary remedy of a preliminary injunction. Nor does holding that the next China.com board election without providing Edelson advance notice of the election constitute irreparable harm to him. In his reply brief to this court, Edelson requested that the court hold the June 17, 2003 election to be null and void, and asked that this court put he and Mr. Bees back on the board. That is not preliminary relief at all. That is the very relief he requests in his complaint. Such relief is not appropriate by way of a preliminary injunction. In conclusion, Edelson is not entitled to a preliminary injunction on a Section 13D claim against China.com because, as a disgruntled former director, he is not in the class of individuals that Section 13D was designed to protect. Moreover, China.com is not regulated by Section 13D and therefore could not be found to have violated that section. And finally, Edelson has not suffered, is not subject to any irreparable harm during the pendency of this case that would warrant a preliminary injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pauly. Sir, you have 4 minutes.
I will try to be quick. There are a number of statements made on behalf of China.com that are frankly somewhat shocking. First of all, the notion that Mr. Edelson's status as a shareholder is irrelevant, I think was the word. Mr. Edelson specifically alleged that he and all other China.com stockholders were disenfranchised. The district court responded to that contention because we have a tainted election. We have Mr. Yep casting votes that swing the balance of the election that were ineligible to be cast under Rule 13D1E2. So the election swings based upon illegally cast votes, disenfranchising the shareholders. Just because you can cast your votes in an election, if the election is tainted and ineligible votes outweigh your votes, you're disenfranchised. So the status as a stockholder is significant. That disenfranchisement causes irreparable harm to Mr. Edelson in his capacity as a stockholder, along with the other body of China.com stockholders. The board, as presently constituted, is invalidly constituted. He is operating with a company that has an improperly constituted board. It is shocking to hear the notion that changes of directors are irrelevant and meaningless because the existing management is in place. Management reports to the board. The board does not report to management. That was one of Mr. Edelson's fundamental beefs with the management of China.com, as outlined in the papers before the court. As to the purpose of Section 13D, one thing I do agree with Mr. Cawley on is that it is designed to protect stockholders as a body. They do need the information to make informed decisions, and they simply did not get it here. There was no disclosure of a contest for control that this was a contested election, and had there been, matters would have been far different. As to the purposes of Section 13D, it's a prophylactic rule. If you're over 5%, you make filings. You make the filings that are required by the SEC. It doesn't say that there has to be a tender offer. It doesn't say that there has to be a pending immediate contest for control. You have to make disclosure filings, and when a change of control contest materializes, that needs to be disclosed. I invite the panel to go to the statutory language, which is the starting point for statutory construction, and to the rules themselves with respect to that. As to China.com's lack of status as a proper defendant in this case, we seek narrow, limited injunctive relief. One has to wonder why a company would oppose simply giving notice, adequate notice of an election, and giving one of its former directors the materials he needs to sit for to try to regain his board seat. That's what we asked for by way of preliminary injunctive relief in the district court. China.com is a proper defendant in this case with respect to the issue of injunctive relief. We're not seeking to invade the corporate pocketbook by seeking damages. We can't do that under 13D. But as an injunctive, as a defendant to an injunction action, a defendant that counted votes that were improperly cast, it is a proper defendant. And the notion that there is no violation by China.com because Yip was not able to cast votes, but nevertheless China.com was allowed to count illegally cast votes, simply makes no sense to us. If the votes were illegal, they should not have been counted by China.com. China.com counted those votes, replaced Edelson and Bees, put new directors in their place. We submit that as a violation on the part of the company. Maybe they could be an aider and abettor. It is substantial participation in the primary violation. And given that Mr. Yip is the CEO and his knowledge would be imputed to the corporation, I think it would be culpable participation within the standards for aiding and abetting.
You said that he was not, his vote, he did not, was not eligible to vote, did you say?
Yes, because he did not file a Section 13D, Schedule 13D, under Rule 13D1E2. If you do not file a Schedule 13D, you then, for 10 days, cannot vote your shares. Your shares are ineligible until you file. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel this morning for your fine briefs and for your oral arguments today. The case will be taken under advisement.